In this video, I'm sharing three things I learned from the book Zero to One by Peter Thiel. Peter Thiel is the famous billionaire founder of PayPal and other companies. And the book Zero to One is a book about innovation. It's a book about how to think about the future. And the title to me was really interesting. He says, we normally think about going from one to N, meaning one to any other variable. And when we go from one to any other variable, meaning innovating, iterating, getting to, you know, a higher level, what we're doing is we're building upon what's already there. We're looking for best practices. He says best practices lead to dead ends, but the best paths are those that are untried. Hence the title Zero to One, because when you go from zero to one, you're building something completely brand new. And he says that the most powerful pattern that he's found in successful people is their ability to find and extract value from places that was completely unexpected. And the way that they're able to do this is by approaching things from a principle-based perspective instead of a formulaic perspective. You know, a formula is the best practice. A formula is here's how things have always been done. But the other way, the zero to one way, is looking for things that haven't maybe been tried, they haven't been tested, and being the one that kind of unearths that. So the first thing that I learned was, it's really a reflective question, that is, what is my answer to the contrarian question? Peter Thiel says that in job interviews, he always asks people, what's your answer to the contrarian question? Meaning, what are you convinced of so strongly that other people think is not true? Or what are most people convinced of as true that you think is not true? He says a lot of people give answers like, well, I think the educational system is completely messed up and needs to be overhauled. And he says, okay, well, that might be somewhat of a minority opinion maybe, but it's something that a lot of people say. So it's not that out of the realm of normalcy. And what he's looking for is someone that's really going out on a limb and putting a stake in their own beliefs and in their own conviction. Because to articulate something that's relatively accepted doesn't take any courage. There's a lot of brilliant people, but they don't have the courage to speak up. The answer, if you have a strong answer to the contrarian question, what it's displaying is both a level of brilliance and intelligence, but also a level of courage that most other brilliant people might not have. A great example of an answer to the contrarian question is that of Dan Pink in his TED Talk on motivation, which I'll link to in the description below. But Dan Pink says that we're normally convinced that employees are motivated by money and by material gains, but that actually the true cause of motivation, the true cause of motivation in the workplace is autonomy, mastery, and purpose, and things that aren't necessarily tied to finances. And so he's saying that here's what most people believe, but here's what I believe instead. The reason that this is important is because to understand the future, we have to understand the past. The reason that the contrarian question is important is because it gives us a different way of assessing the present and the past. And that helps to shape the future. You know, if we go back and we say, well, what are the conventional beliefs that might need to be challenged? We can always look back at things that were popular. For example, the dot-com bust of the late 90s. We know what the conventional thinking was, but we see later that it was a bubble. And it's always easy to identify the bubble in hindsight. The contrarian is the one who's able to identify that at the time that it's actually happening. And that's something that's really valuable. The trick, though, is making sure that you're not just looking for, well, let me find what everyone thinks is true, and just automatically take a contrarian approach for the sake of being contrarian. The true goal, he says, is to actually, it's not that type of thought, but it's developing your own independent thought of everybody else. The second lesson I learned was that competition is an ideology. Look for building monopolies instead. Now, when you understand competition as an ideology, see, competition is assumed to be the way that we do things. And we talk in these war metaphors all the time. We have headhunters and we're gonna, you know, make a killing on this and this competition and that. And he says it's ingrained in us from an early age. So for example, in school, we're competing with one another over our class ranking and our grades and, you know, who's smarter than who and who gets into what college. And then when we get into higher education, it's smart people competing with other smart people very fiercely over getting into traditional jobs like investment banking or management consulting or something else. And we end up going through a lot of energy, a lot of money, and a lot of effort to basically, in the long run, become conformist, as he says. He says a different way of looking at it is that of creating a monopoly. And that might sound really strange because a monopoly has like a very negative undertone to it. But really what he's talking about is something that we find discussed in the book Blue Ocean Strategy, if you're familiar with that. And the idea of the book is that we should stop, you know, competing for market share over the same thing and instead create, you know, the red ocean. We should instead create a blue ocean where we're the only thing, we dominate or create a new market that's not already there. If you want an example, think about when Gatorade first came out onto the market. There were no other sports drinks. There was no category. They created the category, and therefore they were able to dominate it. He gives an example of why this type of competition, or that Red Ocean competition, is a bad thing. And he says, he gives an example of his 3-year span in the, you know, from 2010 to 2013 or somewhere in there. And he says at the beginning, Google and Microsoft each individually had a higher market cap than Apple did. But what they were doing is they were engrossed in competition with one another. So it's Chrome OS versus Windows OS, the Chrome browser versus Internet Explorer, Microsoft Office versus Google Docs, and on and on and on. And in that 3-year time frame where they're basically just creating and knocking off one another's products, Google Search, Bing Search, so on and so forth, Apple ended up having, at the end of 3 years, a higher market cap than Google and Microsoft combined. And one of the reasons for that is what he calls the last mover advantage. And the last mover advantage goes like this. He gives the example of Steve Jobs. He says when the iPod came out, everyone said, oh, that's cute. That's a nice accessory for Macintosh users. But what they weren't seeing was that this was his foray into portable devices in a post-PC world. And when you look at it from that perspective and you see the product line that Apple's released and the trajectory that they've gone down since then, it becomes very clear. And because they're the last mover in that category, they dominate the market. I mean, if they created that category, they're the last one standing because they are so much better than everybody else. And that's what lets them dominate. That's what's better than just being in a competition fighting over percentage points with somebody else. The third lesson that I learned was the importance of empowering people and not making them obsolete. And this is perhaps an answer as well to the contrarian question. Peter Thiel says that technology is not going to make people obsolete. He says technology is actually something that's very vital in a globalizing world, because without technology, we won't have sustainable resources and things of that nature. But people's fear always is that technology is going to displace people, and he says that that's not the case. There are certain things that a computer can do better than a human can do. So a computer might be able to identify patterns in a set of data better than a human being might. But it takes a human being to be able to compare that pattern to other patterns, and to be able to look and figure out a big picture or look for different insights in that data. There's still going to be human element to doing that. He says the path forward is understanding how technology and humans complement one another. And he gives the example of LinkedIn. See, what LinkedIn did, it didn't replace recruiters. It didn't replace human resources. But what it did was it gave them a better way of doing their job. So now a recruiter is able to go through, and they're able to search and filter candidates by keywords, by the amount of experience. And it also gives job seekers or employees a way of managing their personal brand online in a much more effective way than maybe, you know, sending out resumes to hundreds of different companies at one time. But it's combining the human element along with the technology that gives us the best thing. If they had come in and tried to just replace recruiters or replace that HR process, it probably would have failed as a product. But it succeeds because it's found a way to blend the two together. That's three things I learned from the book 0 to 1 by Peter Thiel. If you like the video, please make sure you hit the thumbs up, hit the subscribe button. If there's a book that you want me to do in this format, the three things I learned, please leave a comment below. Otherwise, we'll try to see you next week. Thanks.